This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Gaza is a cipher for the confusion in the world right now. Americans have had a veil ripped off them. They've been shaken from the reverie of junk food and junk telly and junk lives to look and really consider, why are we here?
There's no question that the impact of Gaza has touched on virtually every corner of the world and every segment of almost every society. I mean, we're talking about Muslims, but also non-Muslims. We're talking about leftists and Jews, and we're talking about mothers and grandparents and young and the such. And the kind of reaction to the genocide over the course of the past 7 months has been absolutely amazing. But that impact has not only touched on people, but it has definitely impacted on public opinion, on societies. People all of a sudden, and I have to say I'm someone who's been in this particular fight now for decades, probably for the very first time, I'm noticing this kind of change in media narrative and media coverage. Because of the kind of commentators that are coming on and the things that are that they are saying, how has all of this seen from your point of view? How has it looked? What's your impression of all of this? Especially when you look back at your homeland and the kind of reaction there and the, you know, what's happening on the level of media, politics, everything, society.
There's two things here, isn't there? There are the guests that are coming onto the mainstream and are saying extraordinary things that you go, oh, you can't say that in the UK, but now you can, which are truths, which are self-evident truths, using the word genocide, talking about mass murder, talking about the occupation as a settler colonial occupation, moving the parameters of the debate. But then there's something else. Underneath that is a refusal by Sky News and BBC to change their way of thinking. And they're looking really out of step. So I'll give you an example. A couple of days ago, there was a Sky News presenter at one of the occupation of campus movements in the States. I can't remember which one. And she said, they're chanting anti-Semitic things here. And you can hear them going, we're not moving. You can hear it kind of, it's a bit fuzzy. And she's like, yes, I can't understand what it is, but it's clearly anti-Semitic. And you're like, never. I mean, that's got to be a meme. That's got to be, if there is a moment in media history that represents the now, it's that false framing continuing and making, you know, our mainstream colleagues look stupid.
The press conference that was delivered by Netanyahu a few days ago, sort of lambasting the student movement across America, claiming that they were calling for the death for Jews when there were hundreds of camps erected by Jews against Zionism and against Israel and against the genocide. Proudly standing in the front lines of all of this, it was almost farcical had it not been so tragic.
I know, it absolutely is farcical. And you see now, because everybody has a camera phone, that when people try to fake an attack, it's really not coming across. The young woman who said they stabbed me in the eye when they just walked past and did that. You know, how ridiculous that is. 3, 2, 3, 5 years ago, that there wouldn't have been the counter narrative. The problem is that she can say that on the Piers Morgan show. Piers Morgan will continue to repeat it. And so will the mainstream media until it's, a girl was hospitalized. Are you happy with this? And you say it didn't happen. They're like, it did happen. And so we're kind of post-truth.
Yeah.
We are post-truth. You've got Netanyahu sitting in a studio going, I can't believe that us, the most moral people on earth with the best army, are being accused of terrible things. It's like, and so how do we, and how do our coming generation and those who are awakened to this reality cope with that dystopia? That's the ongoing question. How do any of us cope when they will lie?
But the refreshing thing is that people are seeing through that, and they're seeing through that almost instantaneously. I mean, for instance, that press conference for Netanyahu claiming that there were calls for death of Jews and death to America. I mean, no one was saying that. And then people were responding with images of, you know, people erecting medical tents and, you know, tents where people can have discussions on various issues and creches for children. And this generation, and I experienced this from my own children as well as from those I see, they're extremely nuanced in terms of how to react, how to fact check. You know, that term that we all of a sudden had when Trump came into presidency a few years ago. But now the young are actually doing that. They are fact checking for themselves. They don't. And you're correct in terms of the BBC and Sky and CNN and the like. They're so out of step that people are switching off and they're turning to new forms of information. And the young particularly are immediately getting to the heart of the matter, to the truth. They're finding out for themselves. They're getting to the source of what's happening and they're relaying it in such a creative fashion. So this begs the question, is it that modern technology, which was brought about by the system that I label often as being so corrupt, you know, capitalism and the like, and materialism and consumerism that it's, you know, thrust down our throats. Is it that that has found, you know, that particular way to find out truth from falsehood?
So listen, the whole that the social media, you know, on the ground personal reportage that has come through the last 10 years and 5 years really made given us access. I mean, Gaza was cut off. They think that, you know, Netanyahu and his goons still think we cut Al Jazeera and nobody will see. Of course, that is a horror. And that always precedes a horror. But it's not going to do it because people find ways around it. But here's the interesting thing, and here's what we should be aware of, and I hope really clever people are working on this in this coming generation. They will stop TikTok, and they do stop you on Meta, and they do blind us, and they do promote certain narratives. And the majority of Americans are still buying that narrative because that's what reaches them. So in this fog of social media war, are there, I pray that there are really smart people who are going, we're already 2 years into the alternative. But who will buy into the alternative? If we don't own the mainstream, how do we get the message across? So we're almost kind of coming to the end of communication on TikTok and Instagram. What next?
Yeah. I mean, and the question, what next, is the question that everyone is asking about, because we've been through so many phases, I would say, or events, most of which unfortunately have been tragic and devastating, where we thought that these were going to be the transformative events, but then they sort of...
George Floyd.
For instance, I mean, when that happened, I mean, the whole world was up in arms. All of a sudden, statues of slave masters were being brought down everywhere, in France, in Germany, in Britain, in America. And then it sort of fizzled out a little bit.
So a couple of things on that, because it does relate to the Palestinian struggle. So alhamdulillah, I've been invited to Doha to speak at a Palestinian conference and to workshop ideas on moving forward in collaboration with the Western interest that's coming through these university campuses. And we have to look at the paradigms that already exist. George Floyd seemed to be this changing moment, but then collapsed. Well, I have a theory about that, which is not my own theory. It is out there that the George Floyd Black Lives Matter movement was already corrupted from within, because it was primarily an LGBTQ movement. And you could say that a section of that movement who were highly paid disliked the black man as much as the police force. So you have got a break there. You've got people saying, save this group in society, but not them, right? And it's that all genocides hinge upon separating the men from the women and the children. And so we're seeing this. Let's take it back to Gaza. In Rafah, you've got these checkpoints now. We'll let the women and children through. We'll do horrible things to most of them, but some will get through. But the men, Ya Rabbil Alameen, are they not human beings? We're being asked by these movements continually to separate the men as if they're subhuman and dangerous. And that's an issue for our communities going forward. So when I speak to my Muslim sisters in the Palestinian movement, I'm like, beware of the golden handcuffs of Western liberalism. Because, you know, if once the killing actually stops, and Israel has a number in mind for mass murder, and then they'll go, we're done here, auzubillah, then there will come people coming in and saying, hey, we love your women's empowerment group. Let's do this work together. We'll give you 20 million. It's from this wonderful NGO. And in 5 years, there'll be no hijab, no faith, and no memory of Palestine, and it'll all be coexistence and da 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 da. So we've got to be careful of that. We have to be so strong in our own narrative. And I think I get the sense that a lot of the youngsters from UCL, from Goldsmith, from all of the Columbia, because of the George Floyd movement, they actually are awake to needing somebody else's narrative to be alive and to allowing that. So yes, it wasn't a success in that laws didn't change. Not one life has been noticeably saved, unfortunately, on the streets of America, right? Nobody's got wealthier. No repayment has been made. But those kids were still impacted enough, inshallah, to accept another person's narrative as gold and worth protecting.
Is it also fair to argue that all of these events that I alluded to for the past, let's say, 25 years, they have sort of played an incremental role, maybe, you know, step by step, in order to, for us to arrive at this particular moment where there is this mass explosion of emotions, as well as convictions, as well as a search into the fundamental ideas or so-called values of the fathers, of the bastions of democracy and human rights of the past 50 years or so. Is it fair to say that they have played that role? I mean, for instance, I go back to the anti-war movement that started in 2001, 2002, 2003.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm glad you brought that up, because I don't at the moment know where I stand on protests. On the one hand, this wonderful dynamic energy brings people together. On the other, it's millions of hours that could be spent somewhere else. Isn't this controlled dissent? And the minute it's not controlled, oh, you can march a million people down here, but don't put a tent up there, we'll beat you and take you. Doesn't that tell us that the control paradigm is kind of okay with protests? However, I'm now going to undo that. And I'm going to say in 2003, when millions of us took to the streets against the Iraq cataclysm put in by the British Prime Minister at the time and enacted shock and awe, all of that.
Your brother-in-law.
Yeah, Tony Blair, that we felt disappointed, horrified as things unrolled. And we're like, well, that didn't work. If 2 million people on the streets can't do anything, what's the point? Where's the democracy? But 6 years later, that same prime minister had to leave a little bit earlier than they wanted. And the Labour Party had to kind of maneuver itself and change its outlook because of that. Because we dispersed, but we didn't forget. So I don't know, it's slow change, it's agonizing change. And you have to watch people die and be in pain in the midst of it.
But in a way, I mean, whilst the devastation of Gaza is immeasurable and it's extremely, probably impossible to quantify, I mean, we continue to talk about these tens of thousands killed, tens of thousands injured, and thousands upon thousands under the rubble still. But it's not a numbers game. It's about the devastation of so many lives, of so many dreams, of so many potentials, of so many aspirations. It's about the devastation of the fundamental values which the Western world particularly held so high since the Second World War, and for which the wars in Afghanistan were fought. The wars in Iraq were fought. So many wars, so many conflicts around the world.
But were they fought for that? We don't believe they were fought for that.
Well, that was why people backed them, because they claimed that it was for human rights. It was for the liberation of women. The very same soldiers who are now arresting young girls across American campuses.
And forcing them out of hijab.
And forcing them out of hijab and treating them in the most brutal ways. The very same.
But it was only ever a veneer. So what's interesting is that veneer a harder sell now? Is it more fragile than it's ever been? Is it the pecking of a bird at the shell of an egg that and something is about to emerge? You can't interfere with that process. It has to be peck, peck, peck and take that amount of time. Maybe. Inshallah, God willing.
What's your impression as to the political discourse, the kind of argument that we need to use this moment in order to impact the political class, to tell them that we don't want this anymore, we want something else? What do you think of this?
You're not going to like this. I don't believe in politics. I don't believe in any of it.
You don't believe?
I don't believe in this class of politicians as having any morality. Something has gone badly wrong with the human being, and it's nihilism, and it is a lack of faith. It's a lack of belief in God. And these, I'm sorry, they are godless, monetized, robotized human beings who you can't reach. It's akin to a physical pain. To watch a girl stand up at a major talk of Hillary Clinton and say, children are dying in Gaza. My family just got killed. And she's like, can you get her out of here, please? And you're like, oh God, there are demons walking amongst us. How do we reach those people? They don't want us to reach them. They'll just build walls and put police in the way. It's almost, isn't it almost a reaching a, just write them off and do something different?
Mm. I have to examine this more.
I just don't believe that they have any ethics. I don't believe there's an ethical system.
You have a point, but my investigation, if you wish, will depart from the point as to, well, in light of the kind of reality that we have. Okay, so the reality is sullied.
Yeah.
Reality is polluted on every single level. I'm with you. You know, I think that the new liberal ideology that's painted everything, that brought us this, that had the facade of democracy, but now, bit by bit, is being revealed as something akin to the kind of brutal dictatorships that we find across the Arab world, only in a nicer garb, in a suit and tie, in a, you know, kind of neat cutlery sort of put in a French etiquette point of view, but is now being revealed by the people who are trying to change that kind of system.
Is it a bit like the end of The Wizard of Oz, right?
A bit.
Where Dorothy's standing there and there's a big voice, I will do this. And yes. She goes behind, there's a little man going,
and you look behind and then it turns out to be nothing whatsoever. Is it a bit of this? And the question is, okay, so how do we start to change all of this? How do we begin to address these issues? How do we get back on the right track, on the track towards building something else? Now, you and I are both Muslims. We have our fundamental beliefs in that, you know, the entire universe is focused and the focal point is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We all know that. But the fact is that the majority of people aren't Muslims and they do not depart from that same point.
Well, now you've raised it. Okay, that's problematic. And that's problematic. Why? Because that void has been filled by nihilism. And nihilism is a structural belief where and nothing exists, nothing matters. And that leads to depression, psychosis, and a very dark, gloomy way of looking at, let me just get what is here now. So when I'm talking about, I don't believe that the political process can work as it stands, I think we have to go deeper into Westernism. Westernism is I'm not so sure about white supremacy. I think, look, there is an umbrella of Westernism, which has been in place for 400 years. And part of that is white supremacy. All right. But the umbrella of this idea of we know what is best and we're going to take what we have and smash every culture until we, the small number, get it. And then you add that philosophy of nihilism, which has been coming through Foucault and through other philosophers in the last 100, 150 years, horrible, toxic, nothing means anything. The hope is, by the grace of Allah, this generation are finding a cause that matters. So do I think this is a turning point? Yes, but it's Westernism we need to be looking at, not tinkering with a deliberately smashed system of politics. Mm.
If you had an audience and you had a few minutes with the young people who are in Columbia or in Harvard or, you know, camping in UCL, for instance, what would be your message to them? If you could, you know, give them something that would assert their fundamentals that led them to leave their classrooms, leave their books and the such and their preparation for their exams, and sit and raise the Palestinian flag and sort of refuse the accusations, the demonizations, the charges that they are being, anti-Semitic, for instance, or the such. They are giving so much in order to be there, to make that sense.
I just want to roll it back a bit too, and I will address that because it's a beautiful question. Okay, let's do that first. I would say solidarity is beautiful, but you can't lead it. You can't lead it because you're still in a place of relative luxury and you have a different way of life. Are you ready for the Muslim women in hijab to say, I want to be married, I want my children to be safe, and I want to worship Allah Ta'ala? Are you really in solidarity? Or are you at some point going to say, this is the way you should live and tell us how to live? That's what we need to be molding now, is a shoulder to shoulder with the oppressed people leading. That's not easy for Westerners to listen to. We have to take them forward on that journey and say, solidarity is what you're doing now. But it only continues if you listen to the people who are having their rights taken from them. So that's going to be really interesting. And I remember when I went to, I was in Gaza in 2009 after Operation Cast Lead. It seemed like it's now a kind of footprint of what was to follow. A horrible period of bombing, mass civilian casualties, 2,000 on that, which seemed massive, subhanAllah. And a journalist, I wasn't Muslim at the time, he said, come and meet my wife. Now, I was in solidarity. I put my life on the line. I'd gone on a flotilla to Gaza. I was in it to win it, right? But still, I came from the West. I had my ideals of what freedom looked like. And in my mind, I thought, she's probably going to be really nice and really boring. Stay at home, mom, nothing to say. So I go to their apartment in Gaza City. And lo and behold, guess what? She serves a feast. I mean, I could not cook that if you gave me 10 days and a team of people with me. And this is something for a guest. And I'm looking going, well, you know, she can do that because she's a stay-at-home mom. You know, I'm brilliant. I've got my mind. I don't focus on cooking. We Westerners, we do something different. So I said to her after this amazing meal, you know, it can't be easy with your 11 children to cook a meal like this. I'm very grateful. It's so patronizing. And I remember she said, yes, it is not easy, especially doing a PhD in further maths. I'm like, I was furious. I was furious inside. And then she proceeded to very politely mop the floor with me intellectually eight days till Sunday. And that was a lesson I had to learn. You cannot bring your preconceptions of who, what, where with you. You have to be constantly letting go. And they're very brave. And we love these kids. Are you ready to let go of what you think the world is? And if you are, then we can make a future together, inshallah.
Again, I come back to where do you start? I mean, because you had this physical encounter. You had this face of it. You happened to go into this person's dominion, into their lives, see them firsthand. Not everyone around the world has that luxury. And especially now, I mean, come on. I mean, sometimes, you know, I think we're so unfair. I mean, what does Gaza need to do more to educate us? What do the people of Gaza need to give more in order to open our eyes.
So painful, isn't it, when you see our beloved brothers and sisters who have taken up the camera. Maybe they were doing it before the genocide, but have been daily saying, I'm not going to communicate with you anymore because you don't care. And I'm gone. You won't see me again. And people are dropping off and people are vanishing. And you don't know whether they're alive or they just don't want to tell us their reality anymore. But your question was, you know, how do we communicate that? And it's a really good one. When I was 16, I remember being on my college campus and a speaker from the ANC came to teach us about apartheid. And you can hear about apartheid from someone who you live beside every day and go to college with and even a professor. But when you have someone who's like, I saw this with my eyes and bring you into their reality and you are joining their struggle, that's far more powerful. So I think the next stage is to equip and help the Palestinian voices who are in English. This is very vital, okay? The Holocaust wouldn't have mattered if it had stayed in German and Yiddish, right? English is right now the language because this is the global elite, right? You've got to get your speakers lined in a row. They've got to be women speakers. You've got to have your people paying for their flights, making sure that they're organized and getting them to speak to as many people as possible. We want those voices. You and me, not you, I should be redundant. I want to be redundant in this. Write us out with the Palestinian voices. But again, one step ahead. The Zionists are like, we can't have them on campus because it's hate speech from the river to the sea. Even talking about Palestine, unless you say it doesn't exist, is hate speech. So I think the first battle is really to delineate American and British laws and European laws about free speech. I think that's actually the first quarter battle.
Mm. I happened to stumble across a video clip where Muhammad al-Kurd from Jerusalem, where he addresses the camera. And he says something quite powerful, but something that is very, very nuanced. And he responds to the charges of either anti-Semitism or the like, or anti-Jewish or Jewish hatred or the like. And he says something which, you know, since then I've been thinking to myself, how can this be articulated in a clear, in a nuanced, in a concise way to today's activists, but also to the general public who are still undecided. And basically what he says is, listen, the fact that my house was robbed by invaders and settlers who happened to be Jewish is not my fault. You can't accuse me of Jewish hatred when it was someone who happened to be Jewish, who happened to be carrying the Star of David, who killed my neighbors, who ransacked my land, and who are now committing the genocide in Israel. Stop asking me this. It's not my fault. Had it not been someone Jewish, I would have stood the same. It just so happened that it was someone who happened to be Jew, who was proud to use their Jewishness in order to justify the killing, the ransacking, the thieving, and the harassing. And still to this very day, I find that enormously powerful.
It's been a very clever trick, hasn't it, to say that, on the one hand, the right wing, the settler colonial mechanisms, they're so violent and so ready to hurt and maim, are at the same time so fragile on the front line that going like this, you stab me in the eye, you made me upset, you're wearing that kafir in the street and I'm feeling triggered. Get a life. I really like and applaud what is being said now. You know you look stupid, right? This whole fake fragility thing, when behind the woman who falls to the ground and nothing's happened to her, are guys coming up and pushing our sisters. And these are associate professors of universities. Did you see that? Jonathan, somebody who was in her face, calling her the B word. And No, we don't put up with it. You're lying and you're whole and you're violent, and we don't have to apologize for our stance.
It's, I mean, the fact that people have the gall to say, I'm offended by you raising the Palestinian flag, when actually the country or the state or the entity that you are defending is actively involved in committing a genocide. And yet I'm the one who should look after your feelings and not raise the flag or not chant from the river to the sea.
Anas, there's a deeper question here about who gets to be angry, right? Why is it always that the oppressed non-white person has to, appease and make a difference in a certain way? So I'll give you an example. You can march along this street, but you put a tent there and you can't. You're allowed to say peace and love, but you can't say free Palestine. Why, as long as we are forced to protest in a mechanism that is shutting us down, then we're not going to make a difference. So I really applaud all of our student leaders who are saying, we're going to chant from the river to the sea. And that is actually not aggressive compared to anything that you're doing. I remember my husband said that as a man from the Caribbean, his most disappointing moment in the whole of the Root series, remember in the 1970s about the slave trade, was when Kunta Kinte, they finally caught what, you know, had a moment of retribution potential against the slave master. And he threw down, you know, the whip and ran away. And he said, as a black person, that made him feel sick, because he saw in that, oh, that's how you sell the Root story. You've got to be nice in the end and play nicely with your oppressor, and we're going to delineate how that looks like.
Mm. Yeah, it's. I think it's. It needs a lot of introspection. It needs a lot of examination as to how we even as activists, as people who believe in the cause, who people who think that we stem from the right place and are saying the right things, I think much of our beliefs as well need a lot of examination.
Telling the Palestinians from the left position for decades, don't talk about your own resistance, is a shame on the movement. And
also, you know, one of the arguments continuously is, and whilst I do not dispute for a single second the fact that essentially Palestine, and obviously the case of Gaza, is a humanitarian issue, but to take away and try to sanction the religious and belief element within, I think is doing the whole cause a great disservice.
Well, where did that lead the Palestinians in the 1980s? It led them to the Oslo Accords. Thank you very, very much. We democratized. We dressed like you. We swallowed. I feel Palestinian. The Palestinians said that they've done this, and they've swallowed the narrative. And here's Yasser Arafat. Here we are. And you just destroy the land from there on in. But in a way, you know, destroy us from inside as Muslims. That's what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about this as an ummah subject as well. Because there, like you say, there is definitely a move to, you know, there are already people looking at what post-genocide Palestine looks like. Today, Tulkarem has a huge invasion by the Zionists on all different levels, chewing up the streets, smashing the houses, killing the young. And once they're done with that, and their dream is to push the Palestinians into an even smaller space, then the Palestinians will be told, now you can speak in this way and you can dress this way, and you've lost Al-Aqsa, but it didn't really matter because Islam is only beneath the. Your question is one about land. There are outside forces who want this to be a flag-waving moment, because what has happened in the Arab world is ridiculous. Everybody behind their little flag, their little invented flag. So how old is your flag? 52 years. Oh, congratulations. And I die for my country. It's like, oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. What, I mean, since you brought up the subject, I mean, what kind of impression does that leave with you when you see, you know, on one hand, we're looking at across America, across the UK, across many cities in Europe, and how people young and old are responding to Gaza, are defying. I mean, I was talking with a friend from Germany the other day, and I mean, Germany has been absolutely horrendous. I mean, and has brought back laws that have been absolutely, you know, in the echelons of history and totally draconian, brought them back particularly for the sake of the pro-Palestine campaign, and have gone full circle, apparently. I mean, they're now doing the very same things that they did, as you know, when the Nazis was in charge, but now they're claiming that they're doing it in order to counter anti-Semitism, but doing the very same things. And yet he tells me that there is not a day that goes by without a demonstration with thousands upon thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of people.
So are we not, I think the problem is we're not hearing the German voice. I haven't heard many Germans interviewed to say what it's like under that. We know that there's this tier of this broken political system who are selling, making money out of the guns and guns, bombs, whatever they sell to Israel, right? But what are the people actually thinking about this, I wonder? I don't know.
I think that would be an interesting discussion to have. But I mean, carrying on from my question, basically, you see this and people defying laws, defying threats, defying intimidation, actual intimidation. And then you look to the neighboring countries, the Arab countries, the Muslim countries, and you see... I don't know whether it's paralysis, whether it's indifference. I'm pretty sure that deep inside people feel, you know, just like ourselves, they're boiling inside, they're simmering. I mean, they're just ready to go and do whatever it takes in order to save a Palestinian child or such. But the fact that, you know, on the face of it, you see virtually nothing apart from pockets.
Can we give that old example, Anas, about the elephant? You get a baby elephant and a circus ties a heavy chain around its front leg for 6 months, and every time it pulls, they beat the baby elephant. When that elephant is big, they can have a piece of rope very light to a peg in the ground, and it won't resist anymore. So I think when we're talking about our brothers and sisters in the Arab world, let's look back to uprisings and protests that have happened that I'm not even aware of in the last 70 years, because there was a huge passion for Palestine. And haven't they been beaten into submission? I was speaking to a Palestinian Jordanian sister, and she said, you know, my father fled the Nakba. And she's very disturbed right now because he will not even watch anything on Gaza. He won't watch it. And he's silent about it. What can you do? What can you do? And her theory, which is interesting, is that a lot of the Arab states were given Western money, right? The golden handcuffs that I spoke about at the beginning. Jordan was developed in the 70s, 80s, and 90s by international aid, right? And they all got kind of fat on the roasted calf and very comfortable with it, and don't rock the boatism. Don't rock the boatism. Now, that doesn't work for somewhere like Egypt where there's mass poverty. But places, other places in the Gulf region, we're doing okay. Don't mess with us. The Prophet, peace be upon him, was once asked, what do you fear for your nation? And at that point, he didn't say famine, hunger, enslavement, poverty. He said wealth. Wealth. And of course, you know, we become wealthy, we fear death, we want to hold on to it, and we lose our focus, we lose who we are, and we lose our empathy.
Yeah. You've been involved with the attempts to sail a boat that would break the siege on Gaza and that would deliver aid. You worked on this for months on end, and you saw activists and supporters come from all corners of the world in order to take part in this freedom flotilla. It might not have transpired, it might not have happened for a variety of reasons, many of which political, but what was your impression? What did you think? as you know, you were making those calls, you were liaising, you were organizing, you were speaking to the media about this?
Let me first of all not accept the premise of that question. I came on quite late because I offered some support with social media. So there are campaigns called the Free Coalition, and there's IHAHA, that the major charity in Turkey,
and their
strategy groups. I wasn't a part of that, but I have been, a part of it for the last 6 weeks, we can say, and I have met the people who were willing to put their lives on the line, because every of the 250 plus people who came from around the world to take these boats to Gaza full of aid knew that there was a high chance of Israeli attack. And I think what we're seeing spread now, and let's talk about the young again on these campuses, is not on my watch. When you ask the elderly lady who can barely remember her own name, to be quite honest, you know, I met her three times a day. She said, "What's your name, honey?" And it's like, doesn't matter. She's like, you know, she doesn't want to live and die with this happening in her lifespan without having done something. And I think that is the most moving thing of all. And on the flotilla this time, there were a great deal of Muslims, by the way, a great deal of Arab Muslims. Jordanians were well represented. I think there were some Egyptians. So that young voice is coming through from our...
And let's not forget the last time this happened, there was the case of the Mavi Marmara, where people were actually killed.
Nine people were killed, dozens injured by gunfire. The Israelis opening fire from lines from the helicopter. I've spoken to survivors who were standing behind a cameraman who's filming it. They shot through the camera lens and took out the back of his head. And a list of people that they wanted to deliberately assassinate on board, which included some shiuch, subhanAllah, that were found later on. And yet people are still willing to do that. And I think if we can really latch on to the fact that hearts move people, and the intellect must follow the heart, and that we must be brave hearts. We're all going to have to be brave in some way. You know, there was, when you first met me 15 years ago, I was considered, along with many other people, a rogue voice. Like, I had people say to me afterwards, "We didn't want to speak to you because, you know, the whole Palestine thing, the rocking the boat thing." And, you know, we were pushed, marginalized, deplatformed by the Muslim community. You know, we need to sort ourselves out. In the UK right now, there have been a number of new councillors voted in on Gaza genocide. What does it mean in the UK platform? I pray to Allah that they don't negotiate their beliefs in order to stay in power.
They don't become a point of negotiation or compromise. Yeah, that's a very good point. And to be perfectly honest, when, you know, I'm part of the Muslim vote as well as various other campaigns in order to get the vote organized. And I have to say that the question that comes up and we're confronted with more than any other probably is, what guarantee is there that once this person who is, you know, saying all the right things right now might not change their position once they're in office?
So the position then, and you'll know this better than me, is if you flood the market, then a percentage of them are going to get through, right?
Hopefully they won't be alone, they won't feel isolated, they won't feel like they're surrounded and absolutely overwhelmed. Inshallah.
Because we're very tired of the Baroness Warsis, and I love her dearly in a way, who are silent in government and then have to leave office in order to say what they actually think. Say it while you're there. Say it from day one.
And by the way, that's not only Muslim politicians. Apparently, most politicians who leave office or are on the brink of leaving office all of a sudden have this, you know, kind of revelation and start speaking and saying all the brilliant things.
You know, I've had journalists say that in BBC news offices, the journalists, young journalists, are crying at news bulletins like, "I'm writing this awful script." You know, where is the backup for them? Where is it going to be their outlet? Are we creating structures that are going to say, we can bring you to this? Where are our young voices going to go? And I think that's where we need to be looking.
What do you think British Muslims ought to be concerned with right now? I mean, obviously we have Gaza, we have Palestine, but what should they be thinking of? Because let me paint a picture. Within my circle of friends, which I'm talking about a couple of dozen, very close friends, we confide in each other and the such. There is quite a percentage of them who I would suggest are virtually tired of everything, and they're looking for someone somewhere else to go, to migrate, to raise their kids, to have families, and to sort of escape from, you know, we used to talk about the rat race, but now it's more than that. It's about, you know, whether you're talking about personal issues and the cost of living crisis, which is, you know, debilitating. It's that bad, as well as the narrative, the escalation and the rise in Islamophobia, as well as, and I'm sorry to say this, but whilst Britain remains far way ahead of France and Germany and the likes in terms of, you know, the scope of freedom and the ability to be active and to say what you think, but comparing to where we were 10, 15, 20 years ago, it is nigh on, you know, an autocracy almost. I mean, the kind of laws that are being brought in. I mean, we can mention the Rwanda law, but, you know, you have the borders and nationalities law, which is just there lingering in the sidelines, just waiting to be at the fore. The ban on protests, the curtailing of freedoms of speech. What's happening to people who dare speak their minds, and what's happening in their jobs, you know, for their future careers, for their pensions and the like. People, you know, are now, I have to say, they're getting tired of where we are. But at the same time, when they ask me, you know, because I travel around, so they come to me and say, you know, Anas, where do you think we should go? Where do you think we should go? What's the good? I'll be honest, I wouldn't dare, you know, give an answer. And that sort of fills me with sadness first, but also trepidation, because I am a believer that we still have a job to do and that we can do that job. That job is not an impossible mission. It's a doable job. But we just need to, you know, organize, open our minds, open our contact books, get in touch with people,
Anas,
and have those discussions.
Do you believe that Islam and attachment to the masjid is going to be a focal point from which beauty can flourish in the United Kingdom? And should that be the starting point?
I would like to think so. And I think it is possible, but I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we're there yet.
So what comes to fill that gap? Business?
That's a very good question.
Egoism.
That's a very, very good question. And that's something that I think more and more people are, not only Muslims, by the way, are sort of asking about. And that's how many, by the way, are finding Islam. I mean, where we're seeing all those clips on TikTok from across the Atlantic, you know, in America, Canada, as well as across Europe, where people are saying, you know, hang on, you know, what's happening in Gaza has made me ask questions that I never thought of posing before. And all of a sudden, I'm reading these verses of the Quran, I'm finding, you know, these answers, which I'm deeply impacted by and the such. I think that is a potential. That's...
Look, can we live simpler? Can we live simpler in the UK? Can we live communal? Can we opt out? We have so much money. We're one of the, we've got the poorest community in the UK and some of the richest. And that's a disconnect. And we need the money from the richest to really go into projects that are going to, at first and foremost, build up the solidarity with their faith, with goodness, with sharing what we have with those in need. I'll give you an example. There was 10 years ago, a masjid who was asked by young women, why are you only having a creche for Muslims? We've got nothing here, you know, and they started to invite them in, and gradually, and that's a beautiful thing. Other masjids offering free health checkups. because you have to wait 2 or 3 weeks and you might not see the same doctor. You know, we have these, a great level of professionalism in the UK. Can we focus on that? Yes, go focus on the politics and it will or it won't work. But in the meantime, our criteria as mu'mineen, as believers, is to serve our community. And when we start doing that, that's where we're going to make the difference. But that comes through us knowing the deen. And if we're still churning out kids with expensive degrees and no deen, well.
What, one of my local mosques actually has the kind of facilities and space to arrange open mornings whereby pensioners come in for a cup of tea and a biscuit, just have a chat, you know, just meet with each other. People who come across living on their own, meeting with virtually no one throughout days and days attend. You know, they come to the mosque every Tuesday morning, I think, you know, for a couple of hours where they meet with others, they linger with, and they happen to be non-Muslims. And then, you know, they disperse once they hear the adhan. And now they know what the adhan is about and they know what it means. And they are asking, well, you know, where was the chap who had such a beautiful voice, you know, from last week and the such. So in a way, mosques have that kind of potential and capacity, but What I personally always talk about in whenever I'm talking or lecturing or such, especially to a Muslim audience, is that we need to understand, I believe, the teachings of the Prophet far better. In terms of, I mean, one of the things I constantly say, and I'm not being, you know, a jurist here or posing as a jurist, but what I, you know, when I hear the word, the concept of the ummah, I personally expand that to include everyone, because they are, you know, the people whom amongst whom we live. Now, calling upon them, inviting them, you know, providing for them, being at their service and the such, I think is the way in which to introduce Islam.
Look, we have the human community and we have the Muslim community, and the Muslim community right now needs to catch the human community. We've always needed to do that. But now with this, we circle back round to nihilism. Kids cutting themselves at 13 because they don't know why they're alive. I was speaking to a psychologist in Turkey, and a child psychologist. I said, what are you seeing? This is really interesting. Tell me. She said, the big thing that she's hearing is, I don't know why I'm alive. And therefore, I don't want to live. Wow. We are there to catch that. And you made me tear up then because, you know, Europe has an aging population. Be nice to Muslims. We'll be looking after you in your old age. And alhamdulillah, we're equipped to do that. I know a wonderful convert sister. She's English as can be, and she's converted to Islam, and she looks after people at the end of life with such care. And but you're not allowed to speak to them about, do you want me to speak to you about God? Would you like that? You can't even, and we just need to be there to catch the elderly and help them. And I was thinking about my grandmother who was, Allah forgive her, a real racist. And I thought she lived in Wembley. And as Wembley was changing, I thought, if that old white lady is walking along a street and there's all our Asian and Arab brothers and sisters there, are they going to help her or are they going to stick to their own? That's when we're not doing our job. That's when everybody has a right to resent us.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you've now seen matters, let's just say, from various perspectives. So I would suggest that you have an impression that isn't available to most people, because you've seen things from outside of Islam, from inside of Islam. You've encountered projects that are of a humanitarian nature, a political nature, and the such. And you've also commented on what is so wrong with the West, probably the world also. I mean, I don't know about China and Russia and such, I'm not an expert, but the Western world today. About, do you foresee, because of Gaza, because of this reaction to Gaza, do you foresee a change of a major nature? Are we to expect a transformative moment anywhere in the near future? I mean, let me tell you what many young people tell me. They say, what's the use of the United Nations? They tell me about okay, so the ICJ case presented by South Africa was absolutely fantastic to watch. It was a brilliant spectacle.
Spectacle of democracy.
But okay, so what's going to happen next? All of this, yet the mainstream media still fails to grasp the very basics of what is truly human. I mean, we, you know, in media, we always tell young, budding media professionals that it's the human angle. It's the human angle. Okay, how much more human can you be? You know, when seeing what's happening in Gaza. Yet, the failure to grasp this, to understand, and to reflect is staggering. But people are on board. I mean, they get this. They understand this. They're having the discussions amongst themselves.
Anas, here's the thing. Gaza is a cipher for the confusion in the world right now. And Americans have had a veil ripped off them. They've been shaken from the reverie of junk food and junk telly and junk lives to look and really consider, why are we here? What is there a purpose? These people have a purpose, stay put. They have a purpose, worship Allah. They have a purpose, look after each other. Am I doing that? And I think that is the revolution that is happening, the self-reflection revolution, but in light of doing things for other people. Because this narcissistic decade that we've had, there's a great documentary, everybody please watch this, called The Century of the Self. Don't know if you've watched it yet, by Adam Curtis.
I heard of it. Yeah.
Genius, right? We have been convinced to look into ourselves, and once I perfect myself, I'm going to be the right person to be around. And in the meantime, you do nothing. Well, I think that's been taken away. And I think the big outcome is going, we're in a fork in the road. I can't say what the outcome is. Are we going towards the end of the times? And in our tradition and our understanding, this is going towards the Dajjal and the preparation for that. Ya Rab, in which case this fitna is small. Or are we another chance for humanity to build something before that ultimately comes? Wallahu alam.
Thank you, Lauren. That was fantastic, yes. Mashallah. Okay.